Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have one of my favorite guests on. I count her as a very close friend and someone I respect highly. We're going to speak with Ms. Lynn Taylor, also known as the Common Core Diva. She's a speaker, she's an educator, and she's a researcher. And everything that she's worked on through every, interview that we've done has been an eye-opening experience. And I wanted to have Lynn come back on today to speak about an article and information that she sent to me called Medication. You know, I don't know how parents do it, Lynn. There's so many things coming at the children and at the parents. It's like a fastball. You know, you don't know if you can hit it or if you can dodge it or whatever. So I wanted to welcome you back today because I know how busy you are.
Well, thank you, Dr. Elena. And it is so wonderful to be back with you, especially in a new year where we've got lots of things coming at us. But, you know, that's the nice thing about teamwork is that the more we work together, the more we can help educate and inform each other.
I agree. So let's start off with, what is medication? I don't think I've ever heard that term.
Okay, well, thank you so much for asking. Actually, it is the combination of medicine and education. And the reason why those of us who have been fighting Common Core for so long have been able to come up with it was because we saw the collusion between the Department of Health and Human Service and the Department of Education. And a lot of our conversations between you and I, and then as well as on air, we've talked about the collusion between the two departments. But Medication has to do more with the fact of the overdiagnosis of children with problems, whether they actually have them or not, the over-medicating, the over-therapy, the just overreach from every angle into a child's life. And, you know, with the service for, Center for Medicaid has just come out with new poverty guidelines. They've also just announced that there's a $50 million grant that's up for grab for states to incorporate more school-based health services, especially for mental health.
You know, that term, if you're a hammer, everything's a nail. I can only imagine if you set up, departments within schools looking for mental issues, you're going to find them, whether they exist or not. And we're talking, well, I'm curious, what's the age group? What are the grades that this is going to affect, do you think?
Well, because you have such a top-down system and because you have such a wraparound system between Health and Human Services and Education, as well as several other federal agencies, as well as state agencies, because we know that feds feed the states, you're talking basically from cradle to grave.
But where are the doctors in here? It doesn't sound like they're going to set up clinics in this classic sense where you have a psychotherapist or a pediatrician, somebody who's actually trained from a medical perspective in this. Who's staffing these intake centers is basically what it sounds like.
Right. Well, and that's an excellent question because I think it would depend on where you live. Because if you look on paper, it's going to tell you, well, the feds give the states money, the states between Health and Human Services and Education and whatever else. Agency that could possibly, come into this, they're going to get the funds. And then it's just this pass the buck system. So when this Medication system first started, it was, okay, we're going to take overburdened teachers, whether they're professionally licensed in medical fields or not. We're going to hand them these assessments for them to give to the children. And based on what the assessment says, oh, well, we might get some medical people involved. We do know that because of the Every Student Succeeds Act, we do know because of the COVID relief money that schools are trying to hire more psychologists and more medically trained people to be on staff for these health-based clinics, because these health-based clinics are not just for the students who go to the school, but for the families in the entire community. That's why it's a wraparound. So when you Meducate, you're not just going after the students of that school. You're going after the neighborhood. You're going after the community.
What this is, you may not be able to answer this question, but it seems very locked. So the child who has a relationship with their private practice doctor, with their pediatrician, with their internist, whomever's seeing them, are they even involved with this? Do they even know what's going on? Is there any communication between this intake system and the doctor who actually should be making these assessments?
Another excellent question. And again, I think it would depend on who you are and what state you're in and the situation. I'm going to sit here because I don't have any definite proof, but I'm going to say, based on what I've seen with the shuck and jive over the money and the paperwork, that if you have a child who already has an established primary care physician or a mental health professional or whomever, I'm sure there's a relationship that goes on, but what we're seeing is because the Medicaid funding is increasing per the state, and we have all these new grants coming in, the net that is cast is going to be becoming so wide that whether you have that relationship with a primary or you don't doesn't matter, because they're going to find ways for the school to double dip into Medicaid to bring in more money, because after all, they have to service the child. Well, here's the thing. If you look at the bulk of where this money goes, it goes for administration. It doesn't go for family services or child treatment.
That's interesting. Isn't that the way with everything, huh?
Mm-hmm. It is. It absolutely is. And this is such robbery. But if you and I were to do anything closely related to this, we would be thrown under the jail, but we're seeing our government at breakneck speed, no matter what department it is, commit this sort of treason and crimes against our families and ripping families apart, and no one is even holding them accountable.
So it begs the question, you know, where you think of the typical psychiatric based or, you know, mental issue based. Usually it's going to be depression, anxiety. But will this expand to gender? And it seems to be a huge treatment pathway that the teachers are getting involved with, helping the child transition, medication, all sorts of things from that standpoint. Is that an offshoot of this, or is it just going to be, not that that's a, you know, anything's bad in my opinion, but is it just anxiety, depression, and that sort of thing?
At this moment, it is mental health and behavioral health. Mm-hmm. Whether gender comes into it or not, Medicaid cannot really touch that right now. But that's not to say, Dr. Elena, that it couldn't change. And I very, very much expect for it to, because if you look at the top-down agenda, if you look at the way that the United Nations has got a hold on American education and healthcare, and this is something that they're pushing, it would not surprise me whatsoever to see our federal government go, okay, yes, now we're going to take taxpayer money and we're going to throw it at Medicaid so that they can pay for all this garbage.
I have to ask, from a medical standpoint, Medicaid is already not the best funded thing that the government runs, right? And right. Over Obamacare, there were plenty of states who didn't take money for their Medicaid to expand to Obamacare. Where's this? Is this taking away from your general Medicaid pool that takes care of the indigent, people who are senior, people with multiple medical problems? Is this pot being shifted to kids at their expense?
And you know, that's an excellent question. And I think right now, the way it's set up is that we have funds for both. But again, with the push to totally get rid of as many people on the planet as possible, you know, depopulation, whether it's getting rid of your older people or whether it's getting rid of the unborn or whether it's, you know, trying to institutionalize people that shouldn't be institutionalized, it would not surprise me to see that funding would shift more towards the living than it would be those who are, as the government likes to say, you know, pretty much got one foot on the grave and one out the door.
Well, this reminds me of the complete live system that was touted by Ezekiel Emanuel prior to Obamacare, where most of the healthcare resources, in his opinion, should be spent on, you know, from I think it's from 5 to maybe 35. It was a very, the people who could be contributing members of society, basically. I think that's what he said. Right. So it sounds like this is just a platform to end, to put kids in the system so that they're part of this medical industrial complex. But when they age out, as we all will, then I guess that's all she wrote, pretty much, right? So,
yeah, pretty much. And we've done shows before where we've talked about, you know, like Mark Tucker, as toxic as he has been for America and the chokehold he had on education, where it was trying to turn it into, you know, top-down system, and, you know, your health care, your education, and your job were all wrapped up into one. Well, he took that system and went to Estonia. And if you look at Estonia right now, you'll see, okay, we have funds for this age group. We have funds for this age group. And, oh, once you get past a certain age, well, the government takes care of you as long as you can contribute in some way. Now, they never say if it's a large way or a small way. They'll take care of you. But then, interestingly enough, they don't say, when your usefulness is done, what your demise is going to be.
This reminds me of the British National Health System, where their seniors are last in line to get treatment. And, you know, the Liverpool Care Pathway, which I think I've mentioned in the past, but for those who don't know, it's withholding food and water until you pass away, especially if you're hospitalized. So that is euthanasia, in my opinion. And if this is the method that they're going to use to save healthcare costs, we all should be looking with eagle eyes at this, because it'll affect everybody at some point. And it's tragic. And it's not like it's saving any money. So from the it actually is making somebody money. Follow the money is always my mantra, but it's not going to be to the families or to the child. Do you find this at all ironic that they're spending so much time on behavioral health, but the success of reading, writing, and arithmetic is pathetic at this point? Nobody's mentioning this.
Yeah.
I mean, is anybody talking about that and being an advocate for what school is supposed to be, which is to educate children and not medicate them?
We have had some people in the past. Is it really being talked about a whole lot right now?
Yeah.
No, it really isn't. And it should be, because you're exactly right. We should be looking at what schools are supposed to be doing, not what they have become. Mm-hmm. But because every student succeeds at turned every school into a federally recognized quasi-medical center, look at what we've got. And we, you know, I've gone back and looked with all this stuff coming up, especially with these new announcements. And I've looked back at some of my old articles where I was discussing the fact about the amount of drugs that were being thrown at our kids, and we're literally killing them and forcing them into these poor states of behavior and mental health. And then sitting here having the government go, oh, well, we've got the solution.
This is, isn't it that that's the way again for everything? Everything is put into this duress. And then the government magically has the secret, you know, the answer to it. And it generally means more control and more of your money being taken or used in a way that doesn't work in your favor, unfortunately.
Right. And that's why I hate the word outcome when it comes to children, when it comes to people, especially from a government view, because their outcome for you is not anything other than putting you in a box that you are supposed to fit in for their purposes, not who you were created to be, not looking at your natural gifts and talents and abilities, not looking at what you have knowledge of or what your abilities are.
No, that's not living, in my opinion. And it creates more of a mental stress on people not to be themselves authentically and not to be able to speak a truth and not be able to you know, how can I say, speak their mind without being put into some category of, you know, troublemaker or some mm-hmm. sort of disruptor. You know, that seems to be the same way in the medical system as well. So let's take our first break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Ms. Lynn Taylor. And before the break, Lynn, you were doing a wonderful job of breaking down what the bigger picture is. It seems, and I wanted, for those who don't understand, when the government says outcomes, you know, mm-hmm. we do testing, people take tests, they score X, and then they end up in whatever field or whatever thing that they excel in. Outcomes doesn't seem to me to be the same thing. It's like they want the result. They don't allow you to get there naturally. They just want the mm-hmm. result, and they'll make it happen or finagle the system so that they get the result that they want. Is that how people should think of an outcome?
Yeah, and here's the most damning part of this is, okay, let's say we have one of these behavioral health assessments on Johnny, okay, and he's in school. Whether Johnny deserves this or not, he's going to be labeled as some sort of behavioral candidate, so he gets in the system and gets intervened and medicated and all this. And here's the thing. He won't have deserved that label, but they're going to apply that label to him to the nth degree, to the point that he ends up being in worse shape than if they had just left him alone and put no label on him.
Let me ask a side to that question. Once they've assessed a child as having an issue, do they get reassessed? Do they ever say, you know, we need to do this every year, so in case we made a mistake, then we can unlabel the person? Does that ever happen?
You know, if it does, we have not heard enough about it. And I wish that someone, if they have been through this process, would contact you or I to let us know about this. Because from everything that I have seen, it's pretty much like a one and done. And it shouldn't be. But think about it this way. If I'm mislabeled as whatever, and I keep getting passed down the system, and I keep getting all these interventions and all these drugs and all this stuff, pretty soon I'm going to start believing that about mm-hmm. myself. So it doesn't matter if I'm reassessed or not. I've already bought into what they've told me I am. This is why we're seeing so much happen with this gender bending, because we've had so many people from so many different avenues come in and tell people all these lies about, oh, there's more than two sexes, or there's, you know, this, that, or the other. And what do we have? We have a walking population that has totally believed it, and therefore they're preaching now, I am so and so, when they're not. It's the same principle.
I think you can even say that they can say, I am not so and so, and then the education system comes down on them, or the parent starts, and I guess my question, if the parent steps in and says, this is not who my child is, what recourse does the parent have to be a parent, to have control over their child in this situation? You know your child better than anybody, and you know that this is not true. How do you fix that?
Well, here's what I would suggest. First of all, did the school let you know before they started doing this assessment? Because parents should know before these assessments ever start happening so that they can participate. But so often we see our education saying, oh, well, you know, you just get Johnny and Susie here on time. And you know, once they cross the threshold of the school, we're mom and dad, and you don't know anything. So, you know, we're going to do this. And that happens a lot with these assessments, is that the parents are not notified. So check those opt-in forms, check those opt-out forms, because, you know, you might be opting out of a behavioral assessment, but what are you opting into? You have to look at both sides of the coin. You cannot trust the school, you cannot trust the administration. You absolutely cannot. Now, let's say that the school has done something to your child without your knowledge. Then what I would say is that you need to be finding someone who specializes in medical law and get them on your side. You also need to remember that we have the Section 1983 of the 1981 Civil Rights Act that is expressly created so that any right that has been pounced on by any government appointed representative, which, you know, school teachers are paid for with taxpayer money, so therefore they are a government representative, or any other person who is standing in a representative form for that school system. This could go over into the medical side as well. You have recourse against them impeding, damaging your child, your rights, and their rights as well.
That's good to know. And from the educator side, because as a teacher, you spend a lot of time with the children. And for those teachers who are watching this and are, you know, dubious about it, what power, if any, do they have to put, you know, give their opinion, I guess, speak with the parent? You know, they used to have parent-teacher meetings back in the day. But what about the teacher? How are they affected if they're not for this?
Well, those teachers who are stalwart standouts, I think, deserve our cooperation and our respect, because it is going to be awfully tough for them to whistleblow in this sort of system, because we have so many of the teachers who knew how to protect children. They were farmed out due to the Common Core and the teachers' unions and all the teacher programs, because they knew that these type of teachers would be nonconformist, and you can't have a top-down control system when you have nonconformity in any form. Everyone has to be on the same page. Everyone has to drink the same Kool-Aid. If you have someone who's not, then it's going to mess up your system. So all those people who would have been watching our children have been thrown out of the system. So those few who do remain, we need to give them, hey, let's use the Civil Rights Act. Let's talk about it behind, you know, outside of the schoolyard. Let's have meetings. Let's meet with those who can help protect us, meaning lawyers who are qualified in this sort of thing. And you have to be careful of the lawyers, because so many of the lawyers, because the way that the systems have changed and affected our state codes and local codes and federal codes, we have to watch that as well. So we really need to be very savvy about who we communicate with and what gifts can they bring to this sort of table, so that when we need to enact every member at that table, we can absolutely do it. But here's something we need to understand. If a parent doesn't take the time to show up at every opportunity they possibly can and what's going on in their child's education, then those people who are showing up are basically going to sit there and dissect what your family does and what they don't do. If you don't have a seat at that table, you don't get to eat. And if you do sit at that table, then you can affect the conversation.
That's good to know. So are you saying things like going to the school board meetings? Because this is not talked about, I would think, in a school board meeting. I mean, it's kind of like it's hidden. You really would have to be kind of in the know to bring this up. But if, let's say, you are a parent, you are in the know, is there any power to making this public in like a school board meeting setting?
Absolutely, because most of the school board meetings are pre-recorded. Most of them are asking for people to sign up so that they can speak out. So that part would be the pre-registration, that sort of thing. That would go on. Absolutely. Pre-register to speak. You may only have 3 minutes, which I think is an absolute atrocity in our free speech society, but we get 3 minutes, so why not use it? You know, yeah. Absolutely. And you'll hear in school board meetings them talk about funding for school-based mental health. You'll hear them talk about funding for the other things that go on. But if you don't know what you're looking for or don't know what to listen for, that's the problem. And a lot of parents don't. So in the Meducation article that I sent you, which I hope that you can help get out to everyone, American Policy Center is going to be publishing it. So that'll be a good thing. I show you in the article some of the places that you can look, like Medicaid block grants. And what a Medicaid block grant is that means that your state has given your town a block set of dollars to use for anything in your city for Medicaid, be it school related or not. And because it's a block grant, it means Orwellian outreach. If it was a Medicaid school grant, then it could only go to the school. But by being a block grant, it has coverage over your entire town.
So that answers part of my question about how it gets divvied up. So I can imagine they can really skew this so that most of the monies come into the school system, because from their standpoint, if you can capture these children before, in their formative years, you basically have changed the whole population. You know, it's just a matter of waiting for people to age in and age out. And then you've got a captive audience with no questions asked.
Well, absolutely. And here are two federal acts that have trickled down to our states and to our local levels. And one was called the Bipartisan Safer Schools Act, that beefed up behavioral and mental health and physical health education to levels that, as we've already said, could be criminal for us, but because the government does it, it's A-okay. Then you have the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. And that's what this new information from Medicaid, that's where that one's coming from. So these Bipartisan Safer Community Acts and School Acts, first of all, give us several clues. The fact that it's bipartisan should tell you right off the bat that it doesn't matter if it's a Republican or a Democrat. They're both in on this. The fact that they've got one for safer schools means they're going to focus in on the school and the health care that goes on through the school. When they use the Communities Act, that's when they say, okay, well, we've got the school covered, so here's where we're going to have the school meet the community, and here's how we're going to take it, and we're going to farm it even further out. You also have what's known as free care reversal. Now, this happened around, 2014-ish, 2015-ish, when Every Student Succeeds Act was on the table. And what that means is it gives your school the authority to receive even more Medicaid funding on top of what they already get. We would call it a double dip.
This sounds like, you know, as if it's unlimited money, but it's not. The whole healthcare system it's bleeding money, frankly. And people, I mean, if you think about the whole structure, people can't afford to buy medicines for chronic illness. And this money is going to be potentially taken from them, so that it makes it harder for you to care for your patient. If you're an internal medicine doctor, a geriatrician, somebody who's in the general part of the Medicaid pool, it just seems it's unbelievable. Now, I know we're going to take a break in a minute, but I wanted to start the conversation with, and I know you've mentioned this before, but I'm curious, and I'll let you answer after the break. If you homeschool your children, can you get out of this trap? So I'll let you answer that when we come back. So let's take our second break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living in Solution. We're speaking with Miss Lynn Taylor, the Common Core Diva. You can go to her website, commoncorediva.com, to see her podcast, learn more about what she's writing, and also really give, because what Lynn does is invaluable. And she's doing this with love, and just you're giving everything you've got. And I think people need to know that so they can give to you, because you deserve it. So,
oh, thank you, my dear.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Now, before the break, I was asking if there's any way out of this mousetrap. And like, if you were to do homeschooling for your child, are they still having to do assessments in that kind of system?
You know, that's very interesting, because it depends. If the homeschool family is using IEPs, or individual education programs, that's going to tie into the Medicaid funding. If they're receiving any sort of orthopedic service or any sort of thing that has to do with speech therapy or any of the other therapies that their child needs, that's going to come under this system as well. But we need to understand that, you know, homeschooling might appear to be safe, but we're seeing more and more evidence of where the government is coming in and trying so hard to break that down, because, you know, the homeschooling population is the last nonconforming group we have. They are also the biggest cash cow as far as the government is concerned. And I've been sounding this bell for years. Depends on what kind of insurance that this homeschool family has, you know, because if insurance will cover traditional but won't cover something else, you know, you have that cross to bear. But as insurance policies are changing to become more Orwellian, you need to check your insurance policy as well. We need to stop and remember that this horrible system really got a big boost back at the turn of the 20th century between John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie. And what happened was that Rockefeller was devoting his money to petroleum and then all the byproducts that could be created from it. Now, one of the things that was found to be very helpful was synthetic vitamins. Oh, guess what? I can make money doing what? Selling vitamins. Well, it went on from there to incorporate into mainstream medicine. Then when you have Andrew Carnegie and his fortune come in, they got together as a team because they were both progressives who hated America and wanted to control it and said, oh, let's fund all the American medical schools. Because after all, they teach doctors and nurses. And here we have a true monopoly that was set up. Now, down through the ages, this has changed to favor big insurance, big pharma, and big government to the point that smaller companies and laws have gone the way of the wind. Meanwhile, the Rockefeller-Carnegie system has become standard operating procedure. Now, take into consideration that both Rockefeller and Carnegie got in bed with the United Nations. The Sustainable Development Goals of number 3 and number 4 are, I kid you not, health for all and education for all.
So this is it's a huge puzzle, and it all fits together. Nothing seems to be out, you know, just arbitrary, right? It's well thought out. You know, you think about the medical system, how it's, as you just described it to a T, it's gone from being independent, individualized healthcare driven to this monolithic pharmaceutical, medical school, hospital, insurance company, and don't leave out the pharmacies. They're all connected. I mean, all these silos, for example, where you have the insurance company and you have a preferred pharmacy, and they're all working together. They have pharmacy benefit management companies. All the money is all held within one system. And it now seems like they've segued or moved into the political side of this so that now it's being legislated so that it becomes rigid. And, you know, it's don't get sick, right? If you have a child, you want to pull them out of all these situations because it's designed to find something wrong with you that you'll need a medication for. And, you know,
absolutely.
It's just maddening. And you have these new bills that if somebody has a mental health diagnosis that they can't protect themselves, right? So you might have someone raid your house to take your weapons away because you have a diagnosis that somehow is hung on you that you may not even have. But, you know, it's an issue. I think this is, the individual has to be very careful, very, very careful about everything that's going on. And the parents, it seems also, Lynn, that everybody's put upon. You know, you're trying to live. You're trying to bring home food for your family, have a roof over their head, which is really hard enough these days. And now you have to watch your back on this one as well. I mean,
absolutely. And the thing that grieves me is that we know that there are people in our nation who desperately need quality mental health and behavioral health. We know there are people who desperately need that attention. And what a disservice it is to them to have their needs squandered so that everybody can be in on it, whether they deserve it or not. I mean, that to me is absolutely horrible because I would want the person who I know and love who needs that has been properly treated and diagnosed and all that. I want them to be able to have that because That's what is keeping them alive. That is what is keeping them from suicide. But when we water that down, what are we doing for that population?
They're not thought about at all. I saw it, I think it was a documentary, and it mentioned that there's a huge percentage of people who are incarcerated who have mental health issues. None of this seems to be going to, or homeless. Nothing is going to help these individuals so that they can actually be functioning members of society. They're just warehoused. And it's tragic.
Well, it is. It absolutely is. But we need to understand it's not a one-party fault. It is absolutely both mainstream parties. I don't care if you're Republican or Democrat and you get your toes stepped on for that. It is the God's honest truth. It doesn't matter if we're independent voters or unaffiliated voters or, quite frankly, any of the other parties that are out there, because we're propping up a two-party system because we're being told we have no choice.
That's what they want everybody to think, though, isn't it? That's
absolutely
how the system works. It's take away your power, make you think that you're too small to make a difference. But in actuality, what we discussed before the break was parents starting to get involved, going to these meetings, making their voices heard. And if that's not listened to, then if you have any means, pull your child out of the system so that the money stops going, right? So if now right. I'm seeing a bigger picture here. All these, the teachers' unions against having vouchers and children and parents being able to send their kids to private schools. Is that taking out money from the system? I mean, they need children in seats, don't they, to get this block grant money?
Right, they do. And the scary thing with tax credits and the vouchers and the education savings accounts is because this is taxation without representation. And if it truly was up to the parent to choose where the child goes to school, they should never have to send their money to the government to have it handed back to them. Okay, well, now you can go do A, B, C, and D. No, if you want to be able to have that, then you should be able to do it without the government interfering. But if we have time, I want folks to see why anything tax related or anything that comes to you that has government funding on it is a carrot on a stick to fill those seats, is because the end game of school choice and the 2024 election is going to ride this pony until it dies, and on both sides, because one will tell you, well, school choice will save you from your zip code. And the other one will tell you, well, it'll save you from that other mean, nasty party. And what happens is that the goal of school choice is to take your taxation and your representative form of government and use it against you to take away your rights, shut down every form of private education, including homeschooling, rebrand it as public. And then guess what, Dr. Elena? Those seats you needed filled, guess what? They just got filled.
Yeah.
Now, the reason I know this is because when Every Student Succeeds Act was signed into, as I love to call it, de facto rule, in other words, federal law, back in 2015 under Obama, we know that education and healthcare was expanded. Thus, education, really kicked up. Now, here's what else it did. It reformulated the Medicaid funding for whole schools and communities, therefore taking it away from per pupil need and giving it universally. It embedded the Children's Health Insurance Program into the community funding. It expanded mental and behavioral health interventions, often without proper parental consent. Now, since COVID, both Trump and Biden have implemented even more of these overreaches in these areas, especially for in-home visits of families and micromanaging how they raise their children. In 2018, under the Trump administration, Medicaid block grants were created. These grants are still in use and cover K-12 health benchmarks, in other words, government outcomes, that are also used on any adult participating in a whole school health care program or service. In-home government-mandated health benchmarks. Now, these benchmarks, if not met by the families, are being micromanaged at a local, state, and federal level through the Department of Education, as well as the Department of Health and Human Services. It also created new mandates for the 20 to 64-year-old population, because birth to 18 is covered by tax taxpayer-funded Medicaid, and 65 and older is as well.
Wow. So from the standpoint of these benchmarks, can you give us an example of what is a benchmark? What are they trying to measure? What is the outcome they're trying to get?
Oh, I laugh because, and it's not a laugh as, oh, this is funny, a laugh as in, oh, Lord, we have to go there. Okay. The parameters of the benchmarks are being used as a return on their investment. So in other words, you have now become a commodity for the government to supposedly invest in. And how well you meet these benchmarks is to how much money they will make back on you. And here's an example, your weight, your choice of contraceptive. Do you have chronic conditions? And if so, what are they and how are we treating them? Illnesses. What are we doing to manage those? And if you have behavioral or mental health conditions, the benchmarks are off the charts.
Wow. So just to give people a perspective, from the time that you see your doctor and they have an electronic medical record system and they start asking you questions about, do you feel safe at home? And do you, for the pediatric set, does your child think he's a boy or a girl? All that information, which seems non sequitur, actually gets fed into the system, it sounds like.
Oh, it is. It is such a way to data track you to no end. I mean, they have, if you were to look up, and I think it's on my blog, and I'm sorry, I don't remember which article, Dr. Elena, your data has been put into that system, no matter how innocent it may seem, it does track you. And I'm sorry, I don't have the name of my article right in front of me, but I did one on my blog where I used as one of the headshot images that you see when you get an article. It was the data tracking map and the data connection map from the Department of Health and Human Services, and the amount, Treasury, anybody that you could possibly think, oh, they won't be connected to healthcare, they absolutely are. And the reason why the Department of Revenue would be in there is because our taxes, you know, taxes pay for Medicaid, taxes pay for, from the health perspective, what all taxes pay for other than Medicaid? You could better answer that. But if you ever see an image of that particular data sharing system, it is absolutely, it's worse than a bowl of spaghetti. I'll just put it that way.
You know, from the standpoint of the government, I mean, it's such a monolith. It's very difficult to avoid them, you know, in this day and age. Is there any value into going locally to your state senator, your legislative branch? I understand from a federal standpoint, it's very difficult to get involved with them. But from the standpoint of your local power structure, can you enter that part of it and let your feelings be known?
You know, I think it would be wise for us to remember that because this is bipartisan, we need to know who of our state level representatives and senators have signed on to both these types of things. Because if we are going to the same person who rubber stamped it, we're not going to get very far. But if we go to someone who didn't rubber stamp it, who has stood against it, then we might have a chance.
Got you.
But remember, you've got public-private partnerships. Lobbyists, you've got all kinds of people who are in on this game because, you know, remember, you're a return on their investment.
Yeah, you are. It's a cost center, like you said. On that note, let's take our last break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living in Solution. We're speaking with Ms. Lynn Taylor. You know, that concept of being a cost center is very interesting because it seems to be everywhere. It's happening in healthcare. It's happening, you know, it's outside of us almost, and it's global. And the UN seems to have put their tentacles in everything. And all of these, the structure seems to be emanating from them. Is that a way to see it, that this is bigger? It's like, for the healthcare side, I know that we had to become part of the global healthcare system. We were the last in in terms of the ICD-10 coding, how people, the structure of the healthcare being corporatized instead of being independent. And it sounds like the education system is moved towards that, but then they're all starting to move together so it's one thing. And it sounds to me that if it's one thing, as you said at the beginning of the show, it's a lot easier to control if you only have one power structure and everything is feeding into it.
Right.
I don't think we're going to lose this as long as we can educate people, right? I mean, this isn't lost, is it?
That's the whole goal.
So how can, what are the things that you think that parents and adults can do to pull themselves away from this system?
Okay. I would start with, as I suggested in the article, look at your state departments of not only education, but health and human services. Look at all the partners that they have. Look at all the services that they use, because those entities will also be worth looking at. Look at some of the things, or listen, go back and listen to this and some of the things we've talked about. Take notes on those. Take those notes with you. Compare them with the notes of others in your neighborhood or your circles of influence. Are you starting to see a pattern? You need to also maybe create a local campaign that says, you know, stop the medication. But you would need to define for folks who don't know what medication is. So maybe even start a local campaign of awareness for anybody in your community about stopping the medication. Again, what is medication? It is the purposed collusion between healthcare and education to the point of we're now over-medicating and over intervening with our children. That's what it is. Then also that wonderful gold mine that we have in the Civil Rights Act of 1981, that one section that I've repeated, I don't know how many times, it's section 1983. This gold mine of this law has no statute of limitations on it, Dr. Elena, and it applies to any U.S. citizen, regardless of their age, and it'll address any misuse of any public authority in office. So if your school boards are participating in education, all you have to do is say, you know what, my child's in that school system, therefore they are being harmed by this. That means every school board member is liable. Yes, the school board as a whole is liable, but if you sue a school board, they're going to bring in their big lawyers and their big money. And here you are, an individual. If you make it a personal level retribution because they've made it personal to you and your family, the stakes change. And 9 times out of 10, once these people are put through public notice, using this particular Civil Rights Act in the manner that it should be, 9 times out of 10, the change you are trying to effect will actually happen.
Well, that's good. That gives a lot of comfort to me that you don't have to just sit here and take it. And you should use the system in a way, use their system, because it's not, what they're doing is not, it's not kosher. And having the ability to call them on it. You know, this is all lawfare, essentially, where they're saying that you can do things when they're really constitutionally, it's not right. But if we don't stand up and say no, then it just passes as if it's law and people end up in a system that they don't have to be in.
Right. And the nice thing about this particular Civil Rights Act is it could be applied to not only the egregious mess that goes on in our school systems, but property rights or police duress or any right that you have that has been harmed or will be harmed. That's the other thing, is it's not just what's already happened to you, but what are they planning to do to you? And this is using their law against them. It's not using our law or our opinion. It's using their law, the government's law, against the government. And sweetheart, when you use that, you are golden. If you go up there with opinion or theory, you will be blown out of the water.
That's well said. But the fact that you have the power and you have the knowledge, that should give you a lot of comfort and a lot of ammunition to speak your truth the truth, not your truth, but the truth, and to protect yourself and your family. I mean, this whole thing, does it all stem from trying to break up the family structure and remove the parents and having the government be the parent? I mean, we said this in, I think, a show before about it takes a village. That is a euphemism that people should literally run from.
Right. Run from it. Don't run to it. But what is our government telling us? Oh, no, you need to come into the village. I mean, why are they herding us into 15-minute cities? Because they want us to be that village.
We can't let that happen, because this is something, I just think about the one child who was creative, or who, you know, they're just so innocent, to go in and to have their joy taken from them and have them put upon. It's really abusive. I think there's no other way to put that.
Right. It absolutely is. And, you know, the child abuse that goes on in the name of education is horrible. And if we have anyone who listens to this, who has experienced any of this, please feel free to get in contact with either Dr. Elena or myself, because we would love to be able to talk to you. And I don't want to make an example out of anyone in this situation, Dr. Elena, but if we don't have families who've been through this step up and speak out, how are we going to be able to have our legislators or those in charge of these programs really understand the damage that they have done?
I really think knowledge is power on this one. And this is a call to action. This affects everybody. It's not like it affects just one segment of society. And from what you describe, I really didn't know that it goes up to age 62. I mean, you're talking about the seniors, really. And beyond. Mm-hmm. And this is not a society that we want to live in. It's not like it has our best interests at heart, since it's not really based on facts. It's based on a direction that they want to push society, based on who stands to gain. It's not us.
Right. And remember, our Constitution never would have set up a system that would have penalized any age group for even existing.
Yeah, that's true. In the minute that we have left, Lynn, please tell us how people can give to you and actually contact you to speak for them at their whatever meetings, or educate them in some way and follow your podcast.
Oh, well, thank you, my dear. If you wish to financially bless any of the work that I do for you, you can go to commoncorediva.com. There is a donate tab. You can hit that donation button. It goes through PayPal. If you do not feel comfortable with using electronic funding, you can send me an email at info@commoncorediva.com and we can work something out if you prefer to do it non-electronically. And if you wish for me to come speak to your group, send me an email with your logistics and we'll get that party started at info@commoncorediva.com. And I look forward to hearing from you, because, you know, I've got a lot that I can share with folks. I absolutely do. I've done this for years and it is my joy. It's my call and it's my honor to help arm people so that they can go out and save their family.
I think that's a wonderful place to stop. Lynn, thank you so much for joining me today. Thank you for giving us the information so that we can literally, as humans, take our power back, because this is unacceptable, really.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.